All right. Well, we are live. Hey, this is my 100th episode for the Invictus Mind. So I'm going to mute you guys and get the little intro going here. If you don't mind.
Are you Invictus? Clint, are you Invictus? Are you Invictus?
What does it mean?
You know, when I started the Invictus Mind podcast, my goal was to unite a bunch of people who had a similar ideology or similar characteristic traits. Invictus means unconquerable. It's an old Greek word for means unconquerable.
Unconquerable. So, honestly, just be totally honest, it was a new concept to me. I had to Google it when you sent it to me. but yeah, I do my best.
Tell me about what the show, what is your audience looking for? Tell me.
This is your first time here. This is the number one program dedicated to helping individuals maximize their potential and truly become unconquerable. Here we have discussions about what it takes and what it means to experience and magnify political freedom, financial freedom, and spiritual freedom.
Yes, I would absolutely say that. I'm going to keep getting up, right? And I keep getting up and I keep pushing forward. And that's the type of mindset that you need to have.
I never lose hope. I never lose faith. My mindset has always been, if I want something, I don't give up.
So let me tell you what is the number one issue when it comes to being unconquerable.
Okay.
And the number one word you have to think about here is not intelligence, not savvy, not strength, none of those things. The number one thing is resilience.
You know I'm Invictus. Come on. All right. I'm Invictus AF.
Well, may I have an initiation question for my tribe?
Okay.
Are you Invictus?
I believe I am.
So yes, I agree. I am Invictus.
I totally agree, man. And I think that if there's anybody on this planet that's unconquerable, it's probably me. I am not the type to take orders, and I am definitely in a position that I can stand up for myself right now. So.
And I was like, no way! I know what that word means now.
yeah, man. Very cool concept for a show.
You didn't ask me if I was Invictus.
Welcome, everyone. How are we doing today?
Doing good. What's going on, Mike?
What's up, buddy?
Great. Well, I want to thank both you gentlemen for coming to my 100th episode. I can't believe I made it that far. You guys are like rock stars. You know, what are you at? Like almost 700 now? Over 700 now, Pete?
Yeah, over. Getting into 760.
Yeah. 760. Yeah, you almost at 200, aren't you, Tommy?
Oh no, I'm way over 200. I quit counting at 280. I was like, this is the numbers are getting too high for my brilliance. I just can't do this.
You know,
I feel bad, like, because I was on 100th like Kyle Matovic's 100th episode a couple of weeks ago, and I had a surprise for him. Quincy was actually staying the night at my house that night, and I was able to get Quincy to come in here shirtless and do a dance. But I have nothing like that planned for you. I really apologize, Mike.
Oh, well, I'm glad. So thank you. Well, I want to start from the beginning because, Tommy, you were the very first person that I ever was a guest on a podcast. I don't know. It was somewhere in your early shows. And, we chatted and you had a different show to your name, a different name to your show.
Yeah, and we go way back. Yeah, we
did. Been on this program about four or five times. I've been years ago.
Yeah, five times. Yeah, this is like I was watching the intro. I was like, how did I not make the intro? I got to make a better impression. I mean, I've had more chances than anyone.
Well, we've evolved over time, and so the intro it might be a little too long right now, but it is there. Pete, you were in my first couple of teams of shows, and then I had you on about a year later. This is your third appearance. So for any audience actually listening, why don't you guys just give like a 20-second intro as to who you are so I don't have to say it. Because I do have guests. I do have audience members who probably have no idea who either one of you gentlemen are.
Go ahead.
You want me to go?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm the host of the Pete Quinones Show, formerly Free Man Beyond the Wall. And 760 episodes or something like that at this point. And I have a Substack that people seem to like to. It's at pequinones.substack.com. So that's it.
I'm the host of Year Zero at the libertarianinstitute.org. And also have a Substack, TommySalmons.com. Thanks to a listener of all of ours, Steven Johnson, great guy. He bought me the domain and was like, here, you need to own your name, man. I was like, oh, okay, thanks, man. So, you know, that's pretty much all I do other than work my ass off outside and sweat all day. And luckily I'm not doing that right now.
Well, there's nothing wrong with hard work there, Tommy.
So. Don't give my wife any ideas.
Well, once again, I want to thank both you gentlemen for coming on. So as you saw from my intro, you know, this show is kind of eclectic. I talk about things that pertain to political freedom, financial freedom, and spiritual freedom. And, you know, I haven't talked about anything liberty related in a while. And I got to tell you, both you chose, like, I go through these phases where I'm like, I'm tired of libertarians. I don't want to listen to anything anymore. But I've always just maintained listening to both of your shows. And so because we go back so far and I still listen, so I think that by now we're probably friends, right? Pete, I met you at least personally one time. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. So, no, it was, thank you. I don't know how libertarian my show is anymore, but, you know.
I shy away from that label myself, as we all know that, you know, there's been an evolution among thinkers like us over the last couple of years, particularly. So probably not a lot of libertarians listen to me anyway. So I try to focus on what you would call normies only because of my marketing background. But, you know, I want to bring it full scale because, you know, those three elements are pretty important to me. So.
Well, one of the things that when I first interviewed you, one of the things that I found attractive about your the way of your communication was you were communicating ways for average individuals to like find financial freedom, which I'm like, okay, that's what better strategy could you have other than trying to help people figure out ways to become financially free, you know? So, I mean, you're like the poor man's Dave Ramsey or something.
Yeah, you get the poor part, right? It's kind of funny, actually, though, Tommy, because since you and I chatted, I've actually stepped away from my majority role in the financial services. I mean, I'm still affiliated with the company. I'm still, you know, I'm still licensed to sell some of the products. You and I were talking before we started going live. I actually relinquished a couple of my licenses just because I don't want to be tied to the government regulations and everything.
Right.
So I no longer have my Series 6 and 63. Even though there's money I'm missing on the table at a client's meeting, I still have an insurance license. And there's a lot you can do with life insurance. And so, but for the last couple of years, I've just been focusing on learning new skills because, you know, the world is changing so fast. Right, Pete?
Well, yeah, I mean, thankfully, I don't really know where my show would be if at the beginning of COVID, I would have just kept talking about, you know, Ancapistan and how great it's going to be when we get there and everything like that. You know? So my show grew through COVID. And then I lost listeners when I started talking about different stuff and everything like that. And that's fine. But, you know, I'm still able to do what I do and support myself doing it. And, yeah, I think that I'm putting stuff out there that other people aren't. And I think that's why I seem to have a really hardcore core audience. So.
Yeah, Tom, I really loved the, I'm sorry. I'm getting the names.
No, go ahead.
Your name, Pete. I'm trying to talk to Pete and I'm saying your name, Tommy.
Oh, okay.
This is why I don't go live because I suck at this sometimes.
We all do.
Live streams are, I've gotten better at them. Let's just put it that way.
Pete, what I was going to say is I've watched your evolution over the years and I really appreciate it. And, you know, yeah, that word we can, the three of us can laugh about the word libertarianism. And I've actually stopped marketing myself as a libertarian. I stopped labeling myself that. And particularly even stopped selling financial services to libertarians because, you know, Bitcoin solves everything in their minds. So.
Sure. Just tell them to buy Bitcoin. They'll be fine.
Exactly. And then they're all coming back to me like, well, I lost all my Bitcoin. Well, okay. Now what do you want? What do you want me to do for you now? but really, I mean, obviously, I think we still could all agree that, you know, we still want to have some kind of liberty in our life. What we call that, how we achieve that, different avenues, you know, Pete, you say this all the time, you know, we just want to be left alone. But we realize that that's not really possible these days, right?
Yeah. There's that meme that's talking about, like, when you finally get the people that want to be left alone to get active, like, it really goes bad. And that's kind of how I feel right now, because I was apolitical up until I started my podcast. And then it was just like, just full blown balls to the wall, reading everything, getting, I could get my hands on, trying to research everything I could, like, use against, like, the government power and their bureaucracies, and especially the CIA, which was my big trigger. And so, yeah, it's Pete and I are what you get whenever you actually push the everyman to the point of, like, oh, you're not going to leave me alone? Okay, fine.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I mean, if you, there are a lot of people there that are just waiting, seem to be waiting around, and they'll finally do something when the guns are pointed at them. And all right, good luck with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, obviously, we're not going to talk about the non-aggression principle, right? When shit hits the fan, you gotta defend your family. You gotta take care of what's yours. And, you know, that whole philosophy just kind of, I've been following the trends of both you guys and people like Matt Erickson, and, you know, just the evolution between all of us is just really surprising to me. And I think that, you know, what I really have been kicked on talking about is, you know, philosophy more on a spiritual level than, you know, on a political level.
Mm.
Politics to me is just boring as hell. You know, I called myself a libertarian for years, but, you know, it just, I wasn't up to the speed with the latest book that I was supposed to read. So I'm just like, okay, well, you guys are not really doing anything for me.
Right.
But for some reason, well, you know, everyone, go ahead.
That's a short, you know, the kind of books that you're supposed to read if you're a libertarian is, you know, very narrow. You know, it's like, a friend of mine just contacted me today and said, he listened to The Machiavellians by James Burnham. And I said, it's kind of weird now when you can recognize how politics works and kind of put aside how you want politics to work, you know, that you don't want politics to work, and you realize it's just a given. It's like air, you know, it's power is like air, and power is power exists. It can't be destroyed. There's a finite amount of it. I can prove that empirically. And all it is basically people fighting over how much of it they can get.
Mm. So, yeah, it's like when people talk about, they'll talk about balkanization, and they'll bring it up. Well, oh, this is ultimate decentralization. And then it's ending power. And it's like, no, it doesn't end power. It just exchanges power into different hands in a different, like, amount of hands. Right. So you only have so much power to go around. So there's a finite amount of power. And so if you expand the amount of people that are holding power, then they'll have less power. That's true. So if you look at, like, the US and the way it was originally organized, and you know this, Michael, because your brother Jason is brilliant on the subject of the Constitution, that the way it was situated was the power, there was a finite amount of power that was wrested into the hands of 13 colonies, and it was distributed amongst the states, and therefore it rested in the hands of the executives of all the states, and the executive of the federal government had to get permission from the executives of the states to act. And you experienced an inversion of this somewhere after the Civil War, which was probably one of the most detrimental parts of the Civil War, not to mention the hundreds of thousands of people that died. It was the exchange of power, where the power was then centralized as opposed to decentralized. But there, the left actually makes a decent point when they talk about decentralization and their fear of decentralization. When it comes to their worldview, what they are afraid of is having too many demons to fight. So that if you can centralize all the power into a centralized framework of government or corporations or whatever, then they only have one enemy to focus on. And then therefore they only have to radicalize you against one enemy. And if there are 50 different enemies, then radicalizing people against 50 different enemies, that leaves them scatterbrained and kind of running in circles, not able to focus their attention properly against what they really want, which is part of why they have freaked out so much about DeSantis acting the way he's acted, is because this is decentralizing power. It's pulling power away from the federal government, putting in the hands of the states. So they look at, or like think of Roe versus Wade, where it's like, oh, well, the states get to decide now. Well, now that freaks them out because now they can't focus all their attention in one area. Right.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. Pete, I think you pointed this out a long time ago that, you know, everyone believes the federal government is some kind of centralized power, but it is really not. I mean, how many different branches, three-letter branches we have in various states? We don't really have a centralized federal government, even though, you know, what you said, Tommy, is, you know, it sounds true. It sounds like they want that, but we don't really have that as it is. So it's just kind of a hodgepodge of a bunch of stuff.
Well, you know, in order to so everybody thinks the president's in charge. In order for the president to be in charge, he would have to basically
Klaus Schwab is in charge. Be
able to do anything he wanted. Okay.
Right.
And he doesn't. I mean, look at Trump. They were hiding like troop counts in Syria from Trump. I mean, he had no power to do anything whatsoever. Biden, you think Biden's even making, you know, 90% of the decisions that are going on right now? The ATF puts out white papers on how to interpret federal law. Mm-hmm. So basically the ATF on its own, I mean, it's really now the interesting thing about decentralization is that when you understand that the federal government is decentralized, you understand how powerful they are, because imagine if the states were decentralized, they'd be really powerful, but there's no head of the snake to cut off. So, you know, it's like, if you wanted to take over like the Hungarian government, if you took out Orban and his whole, and I'm not, don't anyone do this. If you took out Orban and like his whole cabinet, you could literally have a completely different government in there. You could have a leftist progressive government in there overnight. Who can take over this? No, I mean, it's the only way that this government is taken over is through elite theory. Studying elite theory is elites go to war with other elites for power, and elites that have different ideas, now they can whisper in the politicians' ears, the lawmakers' ears, and now there is change happening. Things are going to go in a different direction, but we haven't seen that in this country. And, you know, it's like, this is the most powerful government. It's most powerful because all of the whole decentralization of it has a lot of power. Every one of these little tentacles has a lot of power, but they don't all work in conjunction with each other. And I think that's a white pill.
Right.
If I may, I'd like to ask Pete a question, because this is a guest that both Pete and I have had on, Michael Rechtenwald. Is a former communist, worked at, what is it? New York,
NYU.
That's what it was. So he was a professor at NYU, and one of the things I asked him about, and I was asking him like, why is it that the left is like so intent on backing this corporate structure? And when you're talking about like ESG, the Great Reset, this type of deal, the left backs it so vehemently. And so this is kind of the premise I'm working off of here. He told me that the reason that the left views it the way they view it, and that they're willing to get behind like Disney or Coca-Cola or Gillette when they're doing these like woke things, isn't because of the virtue signal. It's because they understand that if they're able to move all the power into that one spot, then it's very, very much easier on them to radicalize people and focus them on that target. It's like a centralized target that they can focus everybody on, as opposed to dealing with Florida and South Dakota and Texas. You just deal with that. And so if they can overthrow basically conservatives in the right by backing these corporate structures, then they can infiltrate and dominate these corporate structures and overthrow them in the end. And they only have to worry about that one enemy. It sounded like very Trotsky to me. Like, and you and I have both read some Trotsky. I've never read any other communists. So you might be able to like bring Lenin into this and stuff like that, that I'm not able to bring into it, but it sounded very Trotsky to me. It was like the revolution is always the end goal. You know, that's kind of what I got out of it. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's also, okay, so when you're, if you can take over a Disney, so say you can get Disney to do your will. Okay. What's easier from somebody who was in the military? You, Tommy, I wasn't. Mm-hmm. If you have, say there's a, you know that there's 12,000 guerrillas and they've taken over this town, and would it be easier to send a 5,000 troops in there to take them out, or dropping one bomb?
Mm.
You just drop one bomb, right? If you know where they are, you just drop one bomb. And that's exactly.
I think it depends on what your purpose is, but I see what your point is, because the bomb like destroys like a big mass area. So if your purpose is to do it in discreetly, then you want to send the special forces, you know, you want to send 5,000 CIA agents in to create a coup. But
more what I'm talking about here is I'm talking about casualties. Okay. So if you want to, it's more difficult for 5,000 to go in and take out 12,000 because you're going to take casualties in the 5,000 and everything. But if you know the 12,000 are there and you can pinpoint a bomb and you can take out most of them, that's exactly what having control of Disney is. Instead of having one church over here that you've infiltrated and one school over here and, you know, one diocese over here, you have the biggest corporation for talking that communicates to children and adults, because now they're into now they're into superhero to just put that, I mean, throw that out there like napalm and see where it just spreads. You know, it's not like you're shooting a 5.56 from the friggin' hills and you're trying to take out a target 300 yards away. You're just dropping napalm and you are getting everyone with it. And you see it. I mean, look how much, who would think that the left really is like into Marvel, like into superhero stuff? I mean, when I think of the left, I don't think of that. I don't think that they're into superhero stuff. And now it's like at the point where if you could destroy Marvel, they'd lose like 90% of their memes, because they are like, they're obsessed with this whole superhero kind of thing. And I think it's what they've realized is, they did it in small in increments over 100 years, but now that they have all of these organizations and organizations that have incredible power and the power to communicate and are seen as kind of like authoritative, that's why you would want a Disney. That's why you would want an ESPN. I mean, I used to watch ESPN like every friggin' day. And about six or 7 years ago, I just stopped watching it because it started coming into there. Like all the woke, the left, the radical leftist stuff started going into sports. And I'm like, I can watch sports with the sound off now, to the point where, once COVID started, I just stopped watching sports altogether. I just watched hockey because the finals were actually really good. So, and also hockey is the least woke of any league. I mean, they still had some rainbow
their logos and stuff. It's also cold enough, if they're wearing a mask, you think nothing of it.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, Pete, you said it's been a 100-year effort on that, and that left's part to do that. But I mean, I think they probably recognize the strategy of just corporate America in general. Speaking about Disney, my brother used to work for Disney Time. I don't know if you knew that or not, but they own like 50% of all entertainment, you know, and on the whole planet. Mm-hmm. You know, they own ESPN, Hulu, and not to mention, you know, the theme parks and every movie out there. And so it's just, they recognize, okay, well, so this is how Americans are actually going to be influenced by these corporate entities. So do you think that, you know, the government went back 100 years and said, we're just going to attack Disney, or do they recognize a trend? They're like, you know what, we'll take Disney, and then we'll take this one, and we'll take that. And it was just like a chessboard almost. We're like, okay, we're going to take all these corporations because this is how you capture the American mind. As opposed to your strategy, Tommy, just going in there and trying to, you know, attack one thing at a time. These corporations are merging with each other already. They're already starting to conglomerate together. So they're creating one big attack point.
I think the corporations came last. Wouldn't you say that to me?
Yeah. That's what I was going to say. It is the financial institutions that they went after first. The corporations cartelizing, that's nothing new. I mean, this was happening back in the like early 1900s with the railroads. The cartelization of corporations, that's a typical thing like you have to watch for because of the antitrust violations and this, that, and the other. So they have to figure out ways around these regulations that they have to work with. What they've done is they've weaponized the financial institutions. And so if you don't operate within these guidelines, if you don't operate in a specific way, then you end up with the corporations can't get funding. They can't get loans. Even if they apply, they can't be approved for these things. So you see this with oil and gas right now. This is something that we're dealing with. Like, nobody wants to talk about this section of the gas crisis and the price of gas. Yeah. Okay. They've been approved. The leases have been approved, but the funding hasn't. The financial institutions will not release funding for these oil and gas industries to go out and drill. So like, okay, like, yeah, you're approved to go drill here. I don't know why you're not drilling here. Well, we can't accumulate the funds to finance the drilling. And so that's what you're dealing with. And that's what you're seeing. You're seeing a weaponization of the financial institution, the financial markets, which stops corporations from acting in specific ways, and it moves the corporations in a way. And then as the corporations move, the consumers have to follow the corporations, because the corporations are where the consumers get all their goods.
Yeah. So Tommy, I think it was your show or one of your shows. You've been talking about ESG for a while, and I heard a breakdown of it from the Clint's show last year sometime. I must have missed something here.
Tommy, don't. All right.
Well, I'm fine.
I'm not up to speed here or something, but okay.
That's all right. No, that's all right. Me and Pete are really good friends off screen here. So
we text every day. So it's like, yeah, so there's an inside joke there somewhere.
All right. So anyway, so you had asked me before we were recording, you know, what I think being in the finance world about ESG, and I got to be honest with you, I don't know as much as you do or what I heard from Clint's show, because you just read ESG as an investment option. You know, we're familiar with companies like BlackRock and, you know, all the big ones because they're in the portfolios that we offer our clients. And, you know, but I talked to my mentor. I'm like, what do you think about ESG? He's like, oh, well, it's just, you know, an option. If people want to invest in these green companies, then they can do that. But then I hear your stuff and Clint's stuff, and I'm like, well, it seems to be a lot more nefarious than that. So why don't you explain a little bit for the audience here what ESG stands for, and if you can, you know, do a 2-minute summary or something, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I can do that. But the first thing I would say to a response like that is that if it were just the free market acting appropriately, then you wouldn't have to have the SEC forming a task force. Mm-hmm. But that just doesn't make any sense to me. Like, why do you need the government enforcing standards that are just an option for investors? That doesn't make any sense. It's not the way that markets operate. If you are enforcing a specific standard, then it's no longer a market operation. It is an enforced operation. So ESG stands for environmental, social, and governance. All right. So you have environmental, social justice, kind of in parentheses, and corporate governance, right? And it's kind of the best way I've figured out to describe it is it's like a social credit score. What they're doing is like what I was just describing. They are utilizing financial institutions to, they're weaponizing financial institutions to move corporations in order to get the citizens to move. So if you read a book like The Next Million Years by Charles Galton Darwin, who's a social scientist, and the book isn't a very long book. It's very dry. It's kind of hard to read. It's written from a social science point of view. And what he's making these assessments that we need to get off of oil and gas. This was written in the 40s. He's saying we need to get off of oil and gas. If we get off an oil and gas, it's going to cause the lives of millions. And another thing he says is that humans are not domesticated animals. No matter what Klaus Schwab, Parag Khanna, Harari would have you believe, they're not, like, humans are not domesticated animals. They're wild animals. And so you're not going to force them to act in a specific way. What you have to do is you have to change the environment around them to get them to move in the direction that you want them to move. So the goal of ESG is to change the environment, right? The market environment, in order to move corporations, and therefore the consumers then follow. And so it moves everybody into a more slave bound scenario. Like I would say, like, the ultimate goal, and Aldous Huxley even admitted this when he wrote A Brave New World Revisited, was the ultimate goal would be like a Brave New World kind of scenario, to where you're the corporate structure, like WEF, let's just use WEF as an example. The corporate structure is the global governance, and the governments that we elect into office are then, like, there to represent us to the corporate structure. So the political executive matters less than the corporate global executive. And that's where they're trying to move us. That's where they're trying to focus that attention to and shift the way that we operate into adhering to global corporate adherence.
Something you said there, I'll come back to because it's off topic, but it was really, really interesting, because I think a lot of those structures that they use can be used against them. So, what do you have more about ESG, Mike? Because you have the guy there right there who's, that's the one you want to be talking to.
Well, I mean, it just obviously, for people who don't listen to podcasts as much as I do, you know, they think nothing of it. I think we see that regular average people are opening their eyes, or they're realizing, okay, there's something going on here. Why is, you know, I was a big fan of baseball. That was my sport of choice prior to COVID. And then when they shut that down, I was like, okay, I guess there's no baseball this year. And then as soon as they open up baseball again on opening day, you see, you know, Black Lives Matter on the baseball fields. I'm like, what the hell is this? And so, and then you talk about Disney, and slowly they're putting all this,
because there's so many black people that play baseball,
right? And, you know, and you see all the wokeism in all the movies, and I've been talking to my wife about this for years. You know, there's like an agenda. You know, well, as soon as they legalize gay marriage, you know, they start just pushing this agenda, and it's in every TV show and every movie that you see, and now it's on every advertisement. It's all the same thing.
It reminds me of Lou Rockwell catching crap for writing that article about the Mighty Ducks 2, when he's like, why do you got to force a black hockey player in there? We know black people don't play hockey.
Exactly. Remember, there was that Charles Barkley got in all kinds of trouble because he was talking about black people don't ski. You remember that a few years ago? He's like, it's too fucking cold.
Have you ever been skiing? I mean, come on, give me a break.
Well, now every commercial, you know, the average American family is, you know, has got a gay brother in it, and you know, it's definitely is,
and it's a mixed race family.
Exactly, you know, it's and it has nothing to do with, you know, me being racist, right? That's the word that they're going to call me. I just don't give a shit what people think about me.
Yeah, I don't care. You know, lean into it. Who cares anymore?
Right, right. So I'm
what are you going to do?
Because I was born white, and I go to church, and I have a family. Those are my values, and so I must be an evil person.
Wait, but I'm not white.
Jerk. We're gonna do the jerk.
I mean, it used to be funny,
I know. It used to be a lot of fun.
Right.
But something that Tommy was saying there, if I could just jump in. So he was saying that they're saying change the environment around people, and it basically they're forced to react or change. That's what I've been saying for like a year now when it comes to like politics. Like so there's a lot of people who want more liberty. Okay. I think locally is the best way to work on it. Talking to Brandon Harnish, who's running for office up in Indiana. And then we're talking to Justin Campbell's like in Indiana, you can basically take over a city council in like a year if you really wanted to, if people wanted to. So we've been talking about like Hans Hermann Hoppe's 10,000 Liechtensteins, where you take a town and you basically change it fundamentally, start privatizing stuff, doing stuff like that. Really, why are people waiting for like people to ask for it or for people to want it? Just go ahead and do it, and change the environment around people and see how they react. If they don't like it, they'll leave. If they like it, they'll stay and they'll change and they'll start adapting to it. That's the way you just do it. I mean, really, it's like friggin' Nike. It's like a Nike ad. You just go ahead and just do what needs to be done, get it done. And if people don't like it, screw them. They'll leave. If they like it, you've changed them. And I think that that's really the way to go. It's just, I know people who call themselves libertarians and especially anarchists who are like, I can't be involved in local, in politics. Voting is, it's like, well, then do nothing. Just fucking, wait for everything to grow and get to it. You get to the point where it's a total state. And we have a narco tyranny now, which is preferable to a total state, I guess. I don't know. Maybe a total state would be better if it was my friend was running it. But,
right.
But just do what you want. I mean, it's like, it's immoral. To me, it's immoral to believe that the world, that you have a vision for the world that could enhance human flourishing and be more peaceful, and you don't do everything in your power to make it happen. It doesn't make any sense. Just change it. Grab a group of people, change it fundamentally, and see how people react to it. I guarantee you most people just go along to get along. It's like the people who were wearing communist armbands in 1933 in Berlin. The Nazis go into power and they throw those away, and now they're friggin' marching with the Nazis. People just go. People just, they're malleable. They just want to go along to get along.
Well, I want to go back to what you mentioned before about the book, The Machiavellians. That was a great book. Of course, that was written like in the 40s at some point.
1941.
It was just skipped over like the zeitgeist for as long as it has been until it was brought back in. But so like, being in business, we've always learned about the 80-20 rule, which is Pareto's principle. Right. And so when I read that book and I realized, wow, it can be applied to everything, not just business. It just opened my eyes. It's like, wow, okay. So there's always going to be 20% of people who have power and influence and wealth, what have you, WPI, whatever strategy you want to use. But, the leadership is going to be able to lead people. Like you said, they're malleable. As long as there's that person who can just tell them what they want to know, most people don't really want to take that role, that mantle of leadership. So they just follow whatever the trend is. And so the only way to buck that trend is to find somebody else who has equal amount of wealth, power, and influence, if you would, that can change it. And that's really what opened my eyes about the whole idea of revolution being a circle. It's a cycle that happens in life. And it's never the little man that rises up against the big man. It's powerful people who are changing places.
Yeah. And revolution. Oh, I was just going to say revolution always leads to a new class of elites. Like it never leads to anarchy. There are very few places that you can point to in the world over history that where there's been a revolutionary movement that has led to complete freedom. You know, something Pete and I have talked about is like Charon. That's one. There was Moresnet, which wasn't revolutionary at all. All that was a little community that popped up as a mining town that no country wanted to stake claim on until they did. And once they did, the mining town had no form of resistance or self-defense to fight back against the government. So whenever you're looking at what's going on around us, if you want there to be a change, you have to find new elites.
Right. And the new elites will be the ones leading the revolution. People think that, you know, oh, the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution, you know, that was organic. It was financed by elites. It was run by elites. Right. They always are. And the very rare occasion that the bad elites, a country has really bad elites, and somebody steps up and destroys them or puts them under his heel, well, then you're the new Hitler, and no one can do business with you anymore, and you're responsible for inflation, and you're responsible for gas prices in this country. That's why they hate Putin. Putin destroyed the elites in his country. He put them under his heel. And, you know, he's one of the only ones you can look at in the history of, you know, in recent history who's done that. And as soon as he does that, yeah, American and Zionist interests start calling him the worst things that you can possibly call people.
Right.
So, I mean, imagine that. I know. Shocking. Well, I know.
And this actually all ties back to ESG. Like, if you really look at it, what you're experiencing and witnessing today is you're witnessing elites grab onto this social meme, this like kind of mimetic idea of where society is going, like the wokeness and the SJW, and they're grabbing onto that and they're utilizing that for their own power. So if you look at, like, let's just take this Gillette ad, which I find to be such an interesting like dynamic. When you look at the Gillette ad that caused so much problems, what was that in 2020? It was just a few years ago.
Yeah.
So did that Gillette ad create more customer base for Gillette? No, it had nothing to do with that. Like, they've already like cemented their spot in history, that this is what they do. People are going to buy Gillette razors. That's just the way it is. The majority of people go out and buy Gillette razors. And so what were they doing? They're virtue signaling to the financial institutions in order to get funding to create new product, in order to have that product to sell to the consumers that were already going to buy their product anyway. So it was when you start viewing it from that way, and that you're seeing it's a major virtue signal, and it's so much of a virtue signal that an article came out the other day that the SEC has handed down new guidelines to ensure that these investment firms that are saying they are following ESG standards are actually following those standards, because they're all saying, oh yes, we're all for sustainable development, we're all for the environment, we're all for social justice, but they're doing nothing about it. So now all these companies, all the investment firms that are saying that they're doing all these things are being investigated by the SEC for basically under the Name Fund Act, which the Name Fund Act was basically to say that if you call yourself a financial institution, a financial investment institution, 80% of your business has to fall under financial investment. So whatever you label yourself as, you have to, 80% of your business has to be that. And so what they have found is these people are just virtue signaling. They're just using these ESG metrics in order to get the funding so that they can continue to operate.
That's interesting to me, because so the company I worked for was an independent company, and then it got bought out by a larger firm, an actually international firm, for the securities division of a company. And you probably heard of the company Transamerica. That's is a well-known brand. The pyramid building on San Francisco. But then just within the last year, they've separated the divisions again. So again, there's the marketing and insurance division, and there's the security division. I wonder if that has something to do with what you're talking about, because a certain number of products need to be marketed to under, you know, the SEC as opposed to other avenues.
Could be for what we've
started experiencing is a completely different, like a completely parallel system into which you have like companies like hedge fund popping up like Strive, right? So Strive is financed by Peter Thiel and a couple of other like billionaire, like tech billionaires. And Strive's in complete intent is to compete with BlackRock and say, we're not going to adhere to your ESG standards. We don't care about that. We're going to stay within the traditional model of the hedge funds and these financial institutions. And so you're starting to get this parallel economy, and people really need to pay attention to that, because that could be the saving grace. As much as you don't want to put all your eggs in the basket of depending on corporate structures to bail you out, you do need, like we were talking about, you do need those elites to step up and lead movements.
Mm-hmm. You asked a question on one of your podcasts just recently. I think you were talking to a girl named Courtney or something like that.
Yeah, and Courtney Turner.
Yeah. I thought that was a great episode. And you asked a question. I don't know if I was satisfied with the answer, or maybe it's still kind of lingering in my mind, about whether elites can actually be made, or they just kind of pop out. I mean, can we actually develop these elites, or are they just there and hope?
And I disagreed on this quite a bit, if I remember correctly. And her and I disagree on quite a bit, quite a lot, like throughout all our discussions, which makes the discussions that much more intriguing. It's kind of like like iron sharpens iron. Like whenever I talk to her, I like talking to her because she challenges me. I think there's natural elites, in that there are people that naturally, like the cream comes to the top. You know, like you got the cream of the crop, and that you'll have those natural elites. She does not believe that. She believes that you have to form a movement. And then, like, I'm not trying to misquote her, but I want to say she thinks that you have to choose and promote elites. So she has a very democratic idea of how to get to elite status. And I don't think that's how that works.
It would never work. I mean, if you don't have elite, first of all, you can't make elites. I mean,
Biden is considered elite, I guess. Yeah.
So somebody is. Well,
I'm joking. I'm sorry.
Well, so like, elite to me is like pillar of the community. The old term, pillar of the community. Those are your natural elites.
Right.
I know somebody who I consider to be a natural elite, and watching that person work and seeing what they do, and how they do it selflessly, that lets me know. And I mean, there is some selfishness involved, but it's going to be for the good of everyone. And we just don't have that anymore. So if there were elites that were worried about, who wanted to improve society for everyone, knowing that it would improve them as well, it would improve their life as well. I mean, think about that. That's what we're looking for. The elites we have now are looking to improve their lives only at the expense of everyone else. Okay. Those aren't elites. Those are criminals. I mean, those are just people that need to be removed. And that's the only way you change things. So like, you know, the reason why the Black Lives Matter or the Summer of George protests in 2020 were so effective is because they were financed. There were people paid to be there. And when they got arrested, there were people waiting to bail them out of jail. Now, compare that to the Canadian truckers. The Canadian truckers had no elites behind them. It was a grassroots movement. It was crushed. People's bank accounts were frozen. People who had donated to them had bank accounts frozen. If there were elites in charge of that, it would have went a different way. Another one is the
January 6th.
January 6th, but even better, the Yellow Vest protests in France. Mm. The Yellow Vest protests in France people don't have any idea how many people were out there. There was hundreds of thousands of people.
Yeah,
out
there. That was huge. And it went on for months.
Yeah.
That was not like a joke. They were serious.
Yeah. Mm. No, but they had no elite backing whatsoever, and they got nothing done. There was right. they didn't win anything. Elites are always fighting against elites. I mean, they're you have elites that have a certain amount of power, and you have elites that have a little less power, and they want that other power. They want that that power to take away the power that the ones above them have. And I mean, that's okay. These are the worst elites, because what they should be worrying about is the world around them, but they're not. But yeah, you do not have a movement. There is no movement. I mean, the civil rights movement, completely financed. I mean, any movement you've seen in the history of this country that, I mean, think about the Revolutionary War. Do you think the revolution, they had backers in France. They had backers in England. I mean, there was no way they were going to win that if it was just them. You know, Civil War II. Why did the South lose? The South, by all metrics, the South should have won. It should have been over in a year. They didn't have backing. I mean, they had some backing, but they didn't have as much backing as the North had. And we're talking about backing from people, from moneyed interests. So,
well, now when you say that, you know, there's a natural elite in business, you know, you can teach skills, you can teach wealth accumulation, you can teach influence. I think those are learned skills. But I see, like, the business model that I'm part of, right? I see people who are making six figures, and then I see people who are making high seven figures. And there's no difference in skill level, though, but it's a value system inherent to that person. It's a characteristic trait that's inherent to that person that sells them above, you know, another performer. The question would be, you know, those people already exist. They may excel in no matter what avenue they take, but how do you get them on our side?
I think what you got to, first of all, you have to identify them, and learning to identify them is crucial. Right. Because they may already be on our side, and they just haven't been identified yet. Right. So the way I look at it is the difference between a father and a dad.
Okay.
Right. So your father is a person that is put into a situation that maybe they're not ready for and they're not good at, but they're a father because they ejaculated. Right. A dad is someone who takes on a role and leads.
Okay.
And does it naturally and does it without question, without being asked, without being demanded. That's what they do. They're a dad. Right. And so they love their children unconditionally, and they lead those children. They teach those children. They spend time with those children, and they don't have to be coerced into the situation. So when you look at elites, that's how you have to look at it. You have those people that, as Courtney is talking about, those that are elected into these positions and promoted and learned skills. Okay. There is something about that that is good. Right. So you could, like, let's say you put Pete and I in that scenario, but Pete and I are not Owen Benjamin. Right. Like, there's a hierarchy. And you have to be aware of the hierarchy and the way that hierarchy operates, and that you're looking for the top of the hierarchy. You're looking for the tippy top, as AOC would say. And so that's where you're going. That's where you're aiming. And so you're looking for that person who has that natural ability to love, nurture, lead, and really shine in the most horrid situations, right? And that person will stand out. They'll take the lead when it's necessary for them to take the lead. One of the people I've talked to Pete about, and the reason I brought his name up earlier, is Peter Thiel, is because every time I see something happening, whether it's the Musk deal with Twitter or this Strive Finance or whatever it is, Peter Thiel is right there in the midst of it. And I'm like, I think he's flying under the radar. I think this is the guy we're looking for, at least the type of guy we're looking for, mm-hmm. because he's doing a lot of the work, not asking for any of the credit, you know? And it's like, okay, you're putting your money where your mouth is. You're not looking for the fame or the fortune. You're just doing the work.
And he already has fame and fortune. So how much more? You to come to a point where you get so wealthy that it's not even about that anymore.
Yeah, but he's not Elon Musk. He's not Mark Zuckerberg. Like, he's not an everyday name. If I went to my aunt's house and I mentioned Peter Thiel, she wouldn't have a clue who I was talking about. But if I said Elon Musk, she would know what I was talking about. You see what I'm saying? So he's the cream of the crop. He's not looking to get promoted or be pat on the back and get all this adoration or attention. And maybe that's the guy. Like, I remember like one of the libertarian like models that they would always say, we want the politician that doesn't want to be a politician. We want to have to recruit him and push him into office kicking and screaming in order like to be an honest politician, which is why so many people wanted Tom Woods to run. And they were trying to recruit Tom Woods because he didn't want to do it. Right. And I'm thinking about elites in the same vein as that, as somebody who doesn't necessarily want it, but is just naturally there and doing it. And it's like, you can't help but follow that person.
That's the reluctant hero archetype.
Exactly. Yes.
So, you know, it's just very interesting to me because there are certain personalities out there. And obviously, I still believe that people act with self-interest. You mentioned that, Peter, that, you know, everyone's acting for themselves these days. But there comes a point in time where, you know, you've achieved everything you – I don't know. I'm not one of these elite – you know, I'll probably never be that way. But I like to have more money than I do. But, you know, there comes a point in time where they're not even like, considering how much money they have. When you have more money than God, you know, what is their next in life? So, you know, either good or evil, right? And I think probably what I want to turn this to is the spiritual nature of this type of battle. You know, it's good versus evil right now.
Mm.
You know, you can say it's political, you can say it's self-interest, you can say it's, you know, circumstance, but I really think that the battle that we're fighting for liberty and for you know, the preservation of life is a cultural battle of good versus evil. And what we need is we need some elites that have good values as opposed to evil values, right? Now, how do we find them?
They just got to be looking for them. You know, I don't think that the amount of money somebody has makes them an elite. It doesn't. I don't care. I mean, I do not consider Jeff Bezos to be an elite.
Mm.
I'm sorry. He's just not. I mean, he is, according to this clown world that we live in right now. But he's not somebody that you would want, you know, setting up a feeding schedule in a friggin' nursing home. What you're looking for is you're looking for people who can get stuff done, but also who have influence over other people and who can move, who can make things move. You know, it's like, I know people in my personal life who they just get everything done. The setbacks that they have are usually minor, but they can move mountains when it comes to all sorts of things. The person that you know that you can rely on to get, you know, if there's trouble, they have the answer. That's an elite. That's a natural elite. You know, Hoppe is probably the only person in the libertarian camp, the anarcho-capitalist camp, who even talks about, he's the only one that I've read that talks about elites. You know, and that's what his Property and Freedom Society is looking for, to raise up, to identify and raise up elites, natural elites. Because he realizes, even though he calls himself an anarcho-capitalist, I don't think he believes, you know, any more than Walter Block believes there's going to be anarchy, you know, an anarchist society in this lifetime or anything like that, or many lifetimes. But the closer you can get, the better. And, you know, Hoppe is one of those people who was like, okay, natural elites. We need natural elites. When even in the What Must Be Done, in his What Must Be Done strategy, he talks about you have to locally, you're looking for natural elites, people who will step up and who will do stuff and not be charged and won't charge you for it. You know, I mean, who will just be like, well, if this is for the good of the community thing, you know, I mean, it's not very difficult. The problem is that incentives matter. And most people's incentives are towards self-interest in a selfish way. there are a lot of people who are self-interested who get things done where in their satisfying their self-interest, the people around them are also benefit from it too.
Right.
So I think that's what, when we're looking at natural elites, that's what we're looking at, you know. And Hoppe is another one who talks about the spiritual. I mean, he is a avowed atheist, but he understands that, like, probably the covenant. Yeah, you know, he also talks about covenant communities. The covenant community that will last the longest and be the strongest are ones that have a basis in faith, and you know, and the ones that aren't. I mean, look at our culture right now. Look at the culture we're living under right now. I mean, it's gotten to the point where I'm telling you, and you've already seen it. You've already seen little pieces of it, but we are like 6 months away from a rash of articles talking about how age of consent laws need to be lowered, and you know, how pedophilia is, you know, that's a dirty word that people need to stop using. I mean, I'm sorry. Look at what's happening. And if that starts happening, I mean, it almost seems like they want civil war, because you know, you're going to, we've already seen some backlash of parents following drag queens who've just performed for kids, following them to the car and yelling at them. Well, I mean, I'm not calling for this, but I can predict that if they escalate this, those drag queens, you're going to see them hanging from an overpass.
Right.
And when that starts happening, we are, I've been saying for a while now, we are in the Weimar Republic phase of the United States. Mm-hmm. And what comes next, what came next in Weimar, somebody who rose up through the ranks and said, we're better than this. This is degeneracy. It needs to be destroyed by any means necessary. And people are going to listen to him.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, the last year and a half, you mentioned the spiritual side there, Peter. The last year and a half is actually, I hate the term the white pill, red pill, and all that crap. But a white pill for me, it is very interesting to me that people have found spirituality, because I think we've seen in this culture a decline. You know, the word demon has never been used as much as it has in the last year and a half, in my estimation. And so if there's a demonic force, then there's got to be, you know, perhaps an angelic force out there. And I think it's really cool that a lot of people are finding spirituality, especially in our movement.
I can be the asshole and talk about that.
If you want to be, I got you on to talk.
All right. Well, Vin Armani said way back when this started that people were going to start rushing back to church because what they're seeing with their own eyes in the world is untruth, is falsehoods, is everything unnatural. And there are a lot of churches that are, you know, have a 1500 or 2000 year old tradition that say that they have the truth, and that would draw people back to it. But I mean, to be the asshole, it also seems like that's a gigantic cope. It's a coping mechanism. And, you know, I don't know if everything got better, you know, like say we got rid of all these groomers and pieces of shit, you know, next week or 6 months from now, how many people would stop going to church? How many of those people who rushed back to church would stop? So I hate to be the asshole, but it does seem like that was, if Vin is right about that, and I think he is, I'm almost 100% sure he is right on that, then it's a cope. It's a coping mechanism. It's a way to get by. And I don't think I think when stuff like that happens, I don't think it is, I don't think it sticks. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I think I think Pete's making a good point, because March of 2020, I remember I texted you, Pete, when all this stuff started, like right at the beginning, and I was like, "This looks like Revelation. Like, this is weird. Like, this is, I learned about this when I was a kid, you know." And I've always struggled with my faith and where I stand with God. And right. And I'm okay to a point about that, but I want to kind of shift that, because like, if you want to utilize these stories, if you want to envision like what we're talking about through the power of myth, right? So when we're talking about elites and we're talking about like the operation moving forward and how we should be focusing our attention moving forward, I always think of the story of Prometheus. Okay. Yeah. Prometheus was a Titan that gave fire to mankind. He never stopped being a Titan. We were never able, like mankind was never able to relate with this guy. Right. And so when you're talking about these elites, don't let your personal feelings get involved in that. Your personal feelings should not be what is driving the motivating force behind the way that you're viewing these people. It should all be on observation and what you're seeing around you. And if you're observing a situation that says, I got to go back to church, I have to get more in touch with my spirituality, when that situation stops, you probably shouldn't stop getting in touch with your spirituality.
Right.
And that's what he's saying. It like, I know he's saying, oh, I'm going to be an asshole, which he's not being an asshole. Really. What he's giving is like really straightforward advice. It's not what you see on the surface, and that what makes you feel good, that is always good for you, because what makes you feel good is, you know, drag queen story hour, or you know, like getting a chick pregnant and being able to abort that baby and not have to be responsible. Those are the things that make you feel good. It is the long-term consequences, the long-term effects of your choices that you really have to be paying attention to.
Right. Did you all see the stream that Matthew Erickson did with Adam Patrick the other day?
No, fuck those guys.
I don't like either of those guys. No, just kidding. I haven't
had a chance to watch it yet. I did listen to it. Adam sent it to me, and I did listen to it. And he and I have chatted about it quite a bit. Yeah.
Well, it was interesting because they were talking about this word called phronema, or, you know, for lack of English translation, worldview, if you would, or spiritual.
Yeah, it's worldview. Like the point of view from a spiritual perspective. Yeah.
Right. So now when you say March of 2020, you were thinking this is revelation. That's the Western, according to what they were talking about, that's the Western phronema worldview, that, you know, this is the eschaton, right? This is the end of the world. We better get right with God before the end happens.
Well, I don't even know if I viewed it as the end of the world. It was just, there was so much that was, it was like, you ever listen to Pajot?
Occasionally.
Okay. So he talks a lot about patterns and the way these patterns like overlap, and that you can recognize these patterns. I think that's what it was. I was like recognizing the pattern that had been interpreted. I just didn't have another way of saying it because of my limited exposure to these ideas growing up Baptist, basically retard inbred, that I really didn't understand what it was that I was witnessing, but I knew there was a pattern I was seeing that I could identify with.
Right. And I haven't read the book, The Fourth Turning, yet, but I want to read that one. I'm hearing about it all the time. There's these things called, in my faith, we call them the pride cycle, right? Where men, you know, they go through hard times. You know the thing, hard times create strong men. And weak times create weak men, or good times create weak men. And so it is a pattern. It just keeps going around and around. And then that word revolution comes up again, right?
Yeah.
So it's just a cycle of life. So whether this is the end of time since Christ is coming back, who knows? But a lot of people are going back to church. And you might be right, Peter, because, you know, times are hard right now. They want to find some kind of purpose, some kind of meaning. So they're going to church. But then when times get good again, they're going to forget all about that. And they're going to go and chase whatever makes them feel good. Hopefully, you know, it'll be once my daughter gets old enough and she doesn't have to worry about that kind of crap coming into her life again, because I do my best to protect her, but I can only do that in my home, not in the world.
Chad men create bodega times.
That's one way of putting it. You gotta put that in a t-shirt. So, well, it's been about an hour, boys, and this has been an interesting conversation. I'm grateful that we had it, and hopefully I can get more into some of these conversations more often, because sometimes I feel isolated over here. Nobody wants to live in Illinois anyway, so.
No. Illinois.
Why would anybody?
I'm gonna tell Beatrix you mispronounced Illinois.
Illinois. That's what she said. or what was it? Cemetery? Cemetery? Cemetery?
Cemetery? Symmetry. We'll bury you in my symmetry.
Awesome. Well, cool. Well, then why don't we just give it a wrap right here, and go ahead and plug away again.
Peak and Yonez Show, all podcatchers, and Substack, peakandyonez.substack.com.
TommySalmons.com is my Substack, and then libertarianinstitute.org/year-0/ is where you can find my podcast Year Zero. I talk about all kinds of crazy stuff, and I don't know why Scott allows me to do it, but I do it. So,
all right. Well, I'm going to go ahead and end the broadcast right here. Hey, it was pretty good. Hopefully I recorded. I don't know how the StreamYard works, but I think I'm able to record it. So.